When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
Hi, this is Justin Coletti of Sonic Scoop. Thanks for joining me for this week's episode of the Sonic Scoop podcast. And today, we are going to be bringing you another live Q&A with an awesome producer and engineer and mixer from this year's MixCon. MixCon, in case you don't know, it is a whole series we put on once every year with major producers, engineers, mixers, platinum sellers, multiple Grammy winners, just critically acclaimed people working in their field who make amazing sounding records. And this week, I'm bringing the live Q&A we did for MixCon with Catherine Marks following her MixCon presentation. Catherine, in case you're not familiar with her, is just phenomenal at what she does, and she's worked with some tremendous artists, some of the coolest of cool bands out there. She's worked with artists like St. Vincent, Interpol, Foals, The Killers, Local Natives, Wolf Alice, Blonde Redhead, Depeche Mode, and so many more. She worked underneath and alongside for a long time the acclaimed producer Alan Moulder, who's another one of my favorites. And for some reason or another, Catherine's MixCon 2022 presentation is the most popular one of this year. We talk for more than an hour in this live Q&A, and she brings some tremendous insights into the process, and I think you can learn a lot from her. Before we get into it, big shout out and thanks to this week's sponsor, Soundtoys, making some of my favorite creative mixing effects in the known universe. Try out anything they make for free for 30 days over at soundtoys.com. And they actually sponsored Catherine's MixCon Masterclass as well, and she uses a ton of Soundtoys plugins in it. So she's a big fan. You will be too if you try out their stuff over at soundtoys.com. Also, thanks to GPU Audio. Go check out their free, for a limited time, convolution reverb that runs on the GPU in your computer over at gpu.audio/sonicscoop. That's gpu.audio/sonicscoop. With all that out of the way, let's get right into it. I hope you enjoy this conversation with the great producer, engineer, mixer, Catherine Marks. All right. I think we are going live here. Hello. It's Justin Coletti of Sonic Scoop. Type into the chat box. Let me know if you can hear me. We're just starting this live stream, live Q&A with Catherine Marks. Also, let me know there in the chat box, where are you joining us from? And did you catch the main masterclass that Catherine just did for MixCon? I was really excited to go through this one. Some really creative stuff going on here. The approach to the vocals was so refreshing. So many interesting effects going on. Really felt her really liven up the drums in the before compared to the after too. Just phenomenal work here. Catherine, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Justin, for having me.
Yeah. She is joining us right now from London in the UK in her new studio. And we're going to go through your questions. A whole bunch of really great questions came in during the live Q&A. We'll hit those first. During the live premiere. Now, during this live Q&A, we're going to hit those ones that came in during the live premiere first. And then once we get through some of those, we'll get into questions that you type into the live chat box right now. So if you have any questions for Catherine, feel free to type them in the chat right now, and we'll ask them in the order that they come in. Couple more quick housekeeping notes. We got a MixCon mega giveaway going. We're giving away more than $10,000 worth of free gear from all the MixCon sponsors. So check that out. We got a link in the description and there in the chat box. You got multiple chances to win. So good luck to you. Big thanks also to Manchester Orchestra for letting us dive under the hood of this track. I was reading the comments and a lot of you seem to really enjoy the actual song and production, which is always awesome. And last quick thanks, in addition to Catherine herself, is to Soundtoys. All the MixCon masterclasses are free thanks to our sponsors, and this one was sponsored by Soundtoys. Great fit. I saw a lot of cool and interesting stuff on there that she used, the Decapitator, the Devilock, the Altar Boy, the Echo Boy. Really especially interesting to me to see you use things like Pitch Shifter, like the Micro Shift on drums, which isn't something that, Micro Shift, that's what it is, which I don't think everyone necessarily expects. So let's start there. That was an interesting thing that came up for me is your approach to using things like Micro Shift and doubling on drums. What are you looking for with those slightly less conventional drum effects? What are they supposed to do? What's their goal?
I think specifically on this project, it was more Ethan Grusker, who, as I'd said in the video, I'm much more of a purist, so I like to get the sounds from the source. And this was really the first project for me where I suddenly was just using things that I wouldn't normally use in a different way to see what would come up that was interesting sonically. So it was less about this is something that I want to try and achieve. It was more, oh, what kind of interesting things can we get using these plugins to inspire us? That's sort of where that came from. And it was great. For me, it was definitely like my shackles had been released.
Yeah.
Taken off.
Sounds like. Now, one of the things that you didn't hear in one of the last questions that came in was about your use of pedals on this one. Is that something you normally do, or is that from your shackles being unleashed, the idea of running guitar pedals on this one? And then what kinds of things were you using those guitar pedals for?
No, so I always use guitar pedals for different things that not necessarily guitars. I've been doing that for a long time, more because I like... I'm not the one playing any instruments, so I like to be able to have something that is tactile while a track is running live, and twiddling some knobs like effects, pedals, mm-hmm. delays and reverbs, bit crushers, all those sort of things. That's fun and enjoyable for me. And again, it's like using a plugin, but it has a different it gives you a different response than an unexpected response and a less controllable response. So I enjoy hearing that. And also I think it's more interesting for the artist to be able to hear that through their headphones and react to that, especially with vocals.
Yeah, definitely. First, yeah. Straight question here is from Phil, who asks, can you give a brief example of what kind of panning you tend to apply? It sounded like the panning was subtly different in the final mix from the original and was very nice. So what's your overall philosophy and approach to panning in general and on a track like this more specifically?
So I have no hard and fast rules about panning, but when I picture a mix, I try to look at it in three dimensions. So it's sort of a sphere, if you can imagine. So through EQing, reverbs, effects, I like to, I guess, based on, it's never necessarily to do with balance, it's just where I visually hear it, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So whether something is sort of, I'll try and go back, but if something is here and then something is kind of here in the mix and I kind of want to, I don't know, make them speak to each other, but kind of on an angle. I don't know, it's sort of, I guess it's hard to explain, but it's purely through, again, the initial stages of the mix, those kind of broad strokes will be through balance, quick, you know, flying some plugins on and panning just to see where sort of everything sits and kind of little, the little ear candy, you know, either I want to hear it in the left or right ear or out of the mix. Or sort of part of the mix, but kind of poking forward. I don't know. I don't really have any, it's never conscious, I don't think. But I guess vocals are center.
That was one of the things I noticed kind of going through this is how I would say, and I mean this in a very positive way, how not cerebral you are about mixing, how kind of instinctive and creative it seemed rather than overly considered, you know, that there's a lot of instinct following, it seems like. Do you try to kind of turn off some of your cognition and some of your second guessing as you're working? And if so, how do you do that?
Well, it's because the early stages of the mix is so fun because you never know how it's going to turn out. Mm-hmm. So it's that kind of quick excitement about kind of, you know, brand new audio that you get to have fun with. So that happens in the first 3 to 5 hours. And then I think, as I said, the next day is where the kind of analysis comes in and the science comes in. And then that's when I start to second guess myself and tweak everything to within an inch of its life. Right. But no one, you know, it's the stuff that no one notices. But I mean, as you saw in the video, there's a lot of me kind of opening up a plug-in, looking at the information and being surprised that I did that. Yes. You know, again, because it wasn't a conscious thing, and obviously I didn't kind of go back in and check it and do the things that I might usually do. You know, my sort of security go-tos, mm-hmm. I guess. So yeah, it was definitely a surprise.
Right. One of the interesting things to notice was, you know, how different for me the finished mix sounded from the rough mix. I mean, obviously the same song, but just felt like a super enhanced version of the original mix. And then at a certain point near the end, you kind of played through a couple of the alternate versions of the mix you did, and just noticing how similar all those later mixes sound to each other. Like, you really get 80 or 90% of the way there, it seems like, in those first 3 or 4 hours of fun. And then the rest is obsessing over the minutia that we kind of have to do, right?
I know, exactly. Like the night before shooting the video, I spoke to Rob, who plays guitar in Manchester, and obviously a very significant part of the production and engineering side. And we were going through all the emails of, you know, the notes back and forth, or me sending revisions unprompted. And we were laughing because we were trying to hear the difference. And I'm like, I can't hear the difference. He's like, yeah, I can't hear it either. But we do remember at the time going, oh my God, yes, this is so much better. So a lot of that is psychological, I think.
Yeah, there's definitely a component of that. And yeah, so much of the time, if you can get like the big strokes right, there are so many fine little minute squiggles where if you squiggled the other way, it still would have been awesome, you know. And having the presence of mind to recognize that while you're in it is very difficult, but it's all part of the process. So
there would have been subtle differences, like this tone of the snare, or yes, those would be things that I would refine, or the EQ of the vocal, or how deep the kick sits compared to the bass, or it'll be those things that I sort of really fine tune after that. And again, no one would really notice that, because the song, it's not going to change the feeling of the song, but it'd be right to our preference. But when it gets to that point, I'm usually really happy for you know, to have the kind of tweaks sent back to me by the artist, because it means that if that's all we're discussing, it's, you know, it's nothing fundamental.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. People have asked me sometimes, how do you know when a mix is done? And for me, one of the clearest signs is, well, if I'm obsessing about whether this word in this vocal should be up by 0.2 dB or 0.1 dB, I'm probably done. You know, like when you get to the smaller and smaller changes, I can totally relate to that.
Ethan Gruskas is an amazing quote. I'm pretty sure it's along the lines of, a mix is never finished, it's just abandoned.
Yes, totally. I've heard something along those lines for filmmaking too. Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth in that. All right, Ty the Sound Guy says, currently on tour working as a front of house doing arena shows, and I've been having tons of fun playing with parallel saturation and how that translates to a big PA. Do you have any favorite distortion tricks?
Distortion. It depends on what it's for. Mm-hmm. If I want to add for example, let's say it's a little bit of vocal distortion, I either run it through my pedals, but I'll push up the send so that you get a little bit of high-end graininess through the valves of the pedals or something like that. Or I might just use a little bit of decapitator. That's what I do with vocals. With drums, similar thing. I'll use pedals driving preamps or something like that. It's hard to answer without knowing exactly what it is specifically that I'm going to be distorting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I get it for sure. All right, a couple of notes that came in while the mix was playing, some of the people's comments on the mix. C-Ray Beat says, the final mix seems more open and the vocals cut through more. Drums are more beefy and the overall levels feel better adjusted. Final mix is a lot more impressive and more open. Phil says, yeah, the final mix sounds deliciously crispy and more depth, as someone else mentioned. I like that deliciously crispy mix. And Mr. Morpheus just simply says, she's amazing. So people seem to like the work on here, Catherine Marks. Let me see if I can get to the next questions that came through. No, we had a whole bunch. There's just literally so many questions that's only showing me a few of them at a time. So it's taking me a little bit longer to find them than usual. Francisco Ruiz here says, mixing into an EQ is something that I've never attempted. I definitely have to try that with my massive passive. Any tips there on mixing through EQ?
Well, I mean, it's just sitting right there. I sort of tend to have the settings the same, you know, I very rarely touch them. So as soon as I run all this, the audio through the massive passive, through my mix bus, I'm mixing into, you know, I just sort of accept that that's what it is. And then there'll be a few little tweaks that I'll make, either cutting out 4K, which I boost a little bit of, or cutting out the 270 hertz dip that I have.
So you're in the same frequency spots, but you might change the intensity of how much you're boosting or cutting those spots. Is that right?
Exactly. Yes. And then, I mean, but recently, like, I've fallen out of love with 3K, which I boost on the vac rack. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I just, there'll be little phases that I go through. Yeah, it's, I don't know. I mean, that's an interesting question because I've been doing that for so long that I haven't, all as soon as I run my mix through my mix bus, suddenly everything becomes more open and exciting because of the frequencies that I'm either boosting or dipping.
How did you get started doing that? What was the impetus for you to say, I'm going to mix through EQ? Because some people are afraid to do it. They think you're not supposed to, but I know a lot of great mixers who do. So what are you looking for that EQ to do, and kind of why do you do it, and how did you wind up doing it?
I think after training with Alan Mulder, mm-hmm. he had a compressor and EQ over his mix bus, just mm-hmm. set up the whole time. But two, I think it was one compressor and two EQs. Mm-hmm. So there would have been something like a vac rack, so a really broad EQ, and then something like a massive passive that you could fine tune. Mm-hmm. And so just through that, and then how I got into using a summing mixer was I used to mix through a Chandler summing mixer. And then that wasn't notched, so I found that really difficult to recall. So I got a Fat Busted, which is notched. And then it's just, yeah, I think it's those sort of things are like a security blanket. Eventually I'm sure I'll change the setup, but I'm just so used to that now. Actually, I've taken it for granted. It's a very good question. This question may very well change the way that I work. Well, I didn't know that a lot of people didn't mix into an EQ.
Right. Well, I think it's one of these things that is divisive. I think that often beginners who learn how to mix mostly from magazines and websites are often told, don't compress, don't EQ your mix bus. You don't know what you're doing yet. So just don't do it at all. And I think that's very common advice that's given. And I do understand that kind of advice, because for someone in the early stages of learning audio, you don't even necessarily know what compression sounds like yet. So you don't even know if you're over compressing things. You don't know how far things can be pushed and how far to not push them. So the advice, I think, to a lot of people beginning often veers towards, you don't know what you're doing yet. Get some help. Do as little harm as possible, and hopefully there's someone else somewhere down the line, whether a mastering engineer or a mixing engineer, who will do some of that stuff for you. And I think that's a lot of advice that's given to beginning people. I think some people, even late in their careers, if they have a more purist approach, stick with that. But I think that a lot of mixing engineers who do amazing work, when I get their work to master, the best sounding records that I master sound already almost like they're mastered when they come in. And they're often people who are more heavy-handed on the mix bus than you're quote-unquote supposed to be, you know, if you go by the conventional wisdom given by the magazines and the college professors and everyone who tells you, you know, not to manhandle your audio. But I see you do a lot of manhandling of your audio, in a mix like this one. And I find that that's how real people who make great sounds really work. That said, if you're manhandling your audio without knowing what you're doing, there is that possibility of messing things up. So I understand both pieces of advice.
Of course. I mean, there's things like the Ozone plugins. I mean, they're like crack, you know. It's so easy just to whack something like that on over your mix bus, not really know what it's doing, and, you know, and smash it so that there's no headroom for anything else to happen. It just sounds really loud. But definitely using sort of analog stuff. I think that was part of the fun for me. You know, I started off very timid with the way that I would use the mix bus compressor and EQ. And then as I've started to learn more over the years, I've become a lot more free with how pumping, you know, the mix is, the different settings, how much I boost at the top end or the low end, or I don't know, that part is so much fun to me because you can bring a different character to something that could potentially be quite linear. So I don't know, but yeah, I guess you've got to know the rules to break the rules, but I still don't know what the rules are, obviously, clearly.
Well, that's a benefit of working with great people. And if I imagine even from the beginning of your career, working in great listening spaces. And I think it's often easier to learn how to get good fast when you're working with a lot of people who are great at their craft, say in Alan Mulder and a lot of the artists you're working with. And I would imagine in reasonably good listening environments, which is not where everyone gets to start off learning this stuff. So I think that can help give you a little bit more of that sense of freedom to really work alongside people who developed that freedom over so many years. So this is a question that someone asked later on, but I'll ask it right now because I think it's an appropriate segue. One of the questions was, do you miss working with Alan Mulder and at the studio you're used to working at, or are you happy in your new place? What are your answers there? Do you miss working with Alan at all? What were some of the biggest things you learned from him? And how have you liked adapting to your newest studio?
Oh, that's such a great question. I moved because Alan moved. I'm now in the same building as him again. But he's sort of like 20 meters up that way. Even though we're in the same building, I see him less because the building's a lot bigger. But we still text each other every day, you know, with the sort of face palm emoji, you know, how we're struggling with something. He's such an amazing mentor and support, but I think we are that for each other. There were so many things that I learned from him. I'd worked with a lot of other producers before assisting him and then ultimately engineering for him, who had probably taught me a lot of bad habits, but I'd been taught by a lot of mavericks, you know, who sort of, I learned to break the rules before I learned the rules, I guess, in a way, since we're talking about rules. And he also taught me how to finish things. There was so many basic things I didn't know, like how to use a patch bay or what compression did. What was compression? I mean, we still joke that we don't really know. I actually sent him a link to someone on Instagram explaining exactly what compression does. And I said, here, finally, we can understand. We can learn what compression is. Finishing things. So how things would end up. So before I worked with him, you know, my understanding was I can do whatever and someone else will finish it down the line. But learning from him made me understand how a track would end up sonically. So that definitely informed the way that I produce records because I'm essentially building the mix as I go, you know, thinking about all the frequencies and the spaces that need to be filled, what's kind of, you know, I hear or visualize how it's going to be at the end before, you know, it's been mixed, I guess. Attention to detail, structure, file management, I mean, so many things, just a lot of nerdy stuff, but also a lot of creative stuff. He is very sensitive to the way he mixes, very conscious of not being respectful of like the intention of the production, and also the emotional side I guess, I think, yeah, a lot of the emotion, you know, the way that my mixing is more instinctive, I think comes a lot from watching him for so long. Mm-hmm. It's very sort of similar. Although he's, I mean, he's a lot more, he's much more technically able than I am. He knows, still knows a lot more, obviously. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, a couple more questions for you here. So far, we've had about half an hour of your time, which we're very gracious for. Do you have time to go a little bit longer? Do you have time for a few more questions? Or?
Of course, right. Of course.
Great, great. So next one we have here is from a fellow named Baron who asks, do you ever have to mix completely dry or clean guitars that were recorded through a DI? And if so, how do you approach beefing those up? Do you have any amp sims or plugins you swear by?
I would usually use a in real life amp to reamp stuff like that through.
Gotcha.
I guess.
It's probably a lot more fun that way and a lot more instinctive and intuitive than messing around with plugins, I imagine.
Again, yeah, no, I actually haven't. It's, unless, you know, I'm doing songwriting, I might use a Sans amp plugin or something, but I haven't actually explored the world of amp simulators on as plugins. No, not yet. Good question.
All right.
I will now.
Cool. Here's a question from someone named Vist who says, sounds incredible. Will take me years to grasp everything that has been done here, though. And I think that is pretty much how it works. So keep at it. How many years would you say you've been involved in music production, Catherine? And how many years was it before you felt like you had any clue as to what you were doing?
So I've been doing it for 17 years. Mm-hmm. Over 17 years now. And I'm still waiting to have a clue. but when I guess I sort of assisted and engineered for nearly 10 years before I started to have the confidence to produce. Mm-hmm. And mixing I started pretty much immediately after while I was working with Alan. It was such a great way to learn because on the smaller budget projects that he'd been asked to do, I would essentially do them and he would oversee them. So it was like having my homework marked by, you know, someone as great as him, and that really helped me to learn and build up my confidence in that area. So that was about 2009-10 that I started doing that. Yeah.
All right. Here's a great one again from Ty the Sound Guy. It's more of a comment than a question, but it makes me think of a related question. He says, this kind of mix is one of the reasons why I have no inhibitions about using playback rigs live. A vocal arrangement like this one can be absolutely transporting for the audience, and using these actual elements would be exactly the direction I'd go. So it sounds like he's talking about, you know, he loves the kind of density in this kind of, you know, studio production, and he loves the idea of taking some of this stuff as a playback to go along with live performances. Do you have any experience in helping bands craft playbacks or take excerpts of what they did in the studio and integrate them into their live show? Do you have any thoughts on how that's done or if you ever help bands with that kind of approach?
No, I mean, to be honest, I try and discourage that, especially with the kind of bands that I work with, because right. I think it's restrictive and your performance is restricted to a tempo of the stems. And, you know, you can't be, I guess you can't be free to vary your performance, you know, shift it up from night to night. A band like Manchester, I mean, they just have more people on stage to kind of cover that. Yeah. Or they refine their shows to suit the amount of people on stage, but they wouldn't use track necessarily. Mm-hmm. But I don't want to discourage other people from using backing tracks on stage.
Right.
That can be used really interestingly.
Yeah, I think genre does make a big difference there with a lot of the bands that you work with. As, you know, intricately produced as these things are, they're still, you know, organic, hairy rock bands to a degree. You know, they're musicians who play instruments and who can, you know, make a song come to life in a different way by kind of creating it together on the spot. But there's certain genres where it would make sense to have super intricate backing tracks.
Yeah, of course.
Different aesthetic. Here's a question from, I believe it's Rainfried. Hopefully I'm saying the name correctly. He says, what has been done as far as preparing the mixing session, as far as, say, gain staging, arranging tracks, coloring and naming tracks? You do talk about coloring in the beginning, but anything else that goes on here, aside from the coloring, which you definitely gave us some insights into, do you have like a mixing template that already has your effects set up? Do you have certain naming conventions that you want to follow? And do you think about that idea of gain staging, how hard things are, you know, hitting your buses and stuff? Is any of that important?
I do. And it was something that I forgot to mention. I have a bunch of master faders going into my mix bus. So I will often play with that. How hard is it hitting the summing mixer? So the summing mixer is valve. So, you know, there'll be a nice color if I'm pumping it quite hard, but then how does that impact the overall compression? Again, in those first 5 hours of my kind of broad strokes mixing, I will do a lot of checking the gain stage. I should have talked about that. I forgot.
Well, yeah, I did notice all those master faders, I think at the top of the session, you can see them in the upper right. And I was wondering about that. So it sounds like, are those subgroups for like different instrument groups, or what's the story with the multiple master faders?
Yeah, so I have drums and percussion coming out of one, because then I can put like a compressor over all the drums and percussion and kind of glue them together. Then bass and synths on another master fader, guitars on another, lead vocal on another one, and then BBs on a separate one. And I put lead vocal and BBs on a separate one, because then when I do vocal up versions, I can just put a trim on the master fader bus and, you know, put it up five, up one, 0.5 up plus one, depending on what feels appropriate. So, yeah, there's that setup. And then another thing I should have explained, when I run the mix back through Pro Tools, I have one track running that is without a limiter, and then another track with a limiter, and I print both simultaneously. And at some point throughout the mixing process, I'll start just listening to the one with the limiter on, and I just use an L2007 Massey limiter, which I think is quite transparent. It's usually just for gain, but it also sort of pushes the vocal forward. Yeah. And then I send both to mastering, and the mastering engineer will be either use the limited one as a reference, or we use that to mix into. I'm really kind of pushing the mix hard. You know, it's not like a brick.
So do you end up doing much of your listening through the limited one at the end? So I understand at a certain point you switch to listening almost exclusively through the limited one. Is that correct? Right.
Yes.
So listening through the limited becomes a part of the mix in a way.
Yes, exactly. I start kind of mixing into that. Yeah.
Yeah. Makes sense. Great. All right. A couple more questions here. Baron writes in to say, man, this clarifies so much to me about why my production sounds small and thin. I'm just doing single vocals, occasional harmonies, but not this kind of tripling, quadrupling, etc. I think there are some big productions that sound big even with single vocals, but they're often maybe more sparse. Do you have any thoughts about vocal stacking, how many to do, in which context to do more rather than less? Any thoughts there about vocal stacking and how many vocal stacks you got in this particular track? Is that a lot? Is it the norm? Any thoughts there?
I mean, the Manchester boys love to stack their vocals, and it's so much fun to go through. I mean, the harmonies that they come up with are incredible, and, you know, the vocal screams in the background and the kind of processing that they do of their kids, and, you know, there's just a whole lot of fun stuff vocally that goes on. And of course that is the thing that you connect to all the time. So a lot of their interest comes from, or the interest in the tracks, aside from obviously the drums, bass and guitar and synths, comes from all their vocal ideas. But I've just done a record where it's a female vocal. It's almost sort of, she sings kind of in a very gentle Mazzy Star way, so her vocal would always be very close and drawn up front, but we have harmonies going all the way through. And I did toy with, you know, double, triple tracking the harmonies, but in the end I just went with a single harmony. And I'm probably going to pan it a little bit to the left, a little bit to the right, just to I don't know, to give it a sense of intimacy, I guess. They're, you know, compared to the grandeur of the Manchester Orchestra backing vocals. Mm-hmm.
Great. And another question on panning. This one is about approach to panning using reverbs. Do you pan either sends or returns from reverbs at all, or do you kind of just keep those down the center?
Yeah, of course. Yes.
Any more, of course, as in you do pan, or of course, as in you keep them down the center?
Oh, of course I do. I do pan sends. Yes.
And how do you approach that? Are you trying to generally pan them to the same place as a track, opposite of the track? And how or why would you approach, panning in reverbs?
So, for example, if I've got, I think I explained one of my big side change swell reverbs in the video. If I want, you know, if there's a lot going on in the center or around the center and I want something, it's like a pre-fade ascend to the kind of swell reverb that pumps with the track, I might send it somewhere to the left or to the right, not hard left or hard right, maybe 45 degrees left or right, just so that it has its own sense of space, but it's behind the mix, but not behind the vocal, directly behind the vocal, the lead vocal. Does that make sense?
I think so. Great. That gets us through just about all the questions I could find from the original live premiere. If I didn't get your question in the live premiere, please type it right here into the current live chat box. I want to see if any new questions have come in during the live chat. And yeah, we have a few. Alberto asked a question. This one is interesting. He says, I'm learning a lot. Hi, Catherine. How do you manage artists' stubbornness when they want to do things their way, but you know your proposed ideas are going to benefit the song more than theirs? Interesting question. Do you ever feel that way? And if so, how would you handle that feeling?
No, I never feel that my ideas are better. and usually when I do think that my ideas are better, I'm quickly proven wrong. Mm-hmm.
I know what you mean. And I think that this is something that, at least for me, when I was getting started, you know, when I started feeling competent, I thought, I know better than the band. I'm the one who's been studying audio engineering and music production. But then it's like, actually, they're the artist, you know?
Yeah.
And they have, my job shouldn't be to know more about their aesthetic than they do. It should be, if anything, to figure out what they're really trying to accomplish, what their aesthetic is, and then help them get from wherever their sound is right now to where they were trying to go. It's not to tell them where they're trying to go. It's helping them find the path on the map from where the sound is right now and where they genuinely want to end up, and to even figure out where it is that they want to end up and make sure that I'm understanding that properly. I think
it's about sort of steering them in the right direction to kind of help them achieve what they want to achieve. And also, if they want to try an idea that I disagree with, I can always mute it later.
Right.
You know, I can pick the time to have that discussion later down the line if I just think it's flat out wrong, right, or it clashes or something. But that rarely happens.
Yep. I hear you. Someone here named Clarity says, I've always been nervous of making bold decisions with things like big effects throws. With this particular project, it seems like you had more of a producer role. If you were just mixing, would you still be as bold?
Yes.
All right. Good answer. Oh, I want to ask you a question. What is a vocal spin? How do you define a vocal spin? Because I use that term a few times, and I'm not sure if it's a terminology that everyone's familiar with. So what do you think of when you think of that term, vocal spin?
A spin is when you're sending a vocal or anything to a delay, and then you send that to another delay, and then possibly another delay, and then sidechain it or a reverb. The idea is that it spins. You know, you're sitting in the spin. I don't know. It is basically a vocal throw, I guess, but it's sending like a quarter note or a quarter note delay to then a half note delay, which then goes to a reverb and then is sidechained to like a quarter note beat or I don't know, something like yeah. that.
A lot of fun.
Yeah.
All right. Another one here from Sean Boyles is, how do you handle resonant buildups? Are there any plugins such as dynamic EQs that you favor come to mind? Any tips, any ideas there as far as resonant buildups in a song or in a sound or in a mix?
What would you define as resonant buildups?
Good question, Sean. If you want to clarify your question, it's funny. I mean, some people definitely go through this approach where they kind of sweep through EQs. They try to find a resonant frequency that's annoying and then they cut it. And I get that approach, but I think that the vast majority of people who do that, especially more beginning producers and mixers, are probably finding resonant frequencies in their room that they are cutting rather than something in the song.
Sure.
I find that to be the case more often, but if that doesn't immediately really mean anything to you, resonant frequencies that you need to fix, then I think we can keep on going on to the next question.
I really like the Fab filter. Is it the Q2?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They might be on Q3 now. I'm not sure.
Yeah, but it is. Q2, HA.
Ty says, I love your outlook on pedals. I'm doing a tour right now for the first time and using a big guitar pedal at the front of house spot. And it's a small thing, but a liberating mindset to have to be working with a pedal. Eileen Altavista says, I'm wondering about the purpose behind the selection of your small Genelec monitors. What made you choose the small Genelec monitors that she sees in the shot there?
I bought them initially to, they're small and cute, and I could travel with them. But they're also really good for vocal detail. So if I have them quite quiet, I can test the presence of the vocal in relationship to the rest of the mix. That's basically what I use them for.
And which of your monitors do you think you spend the most time on currently?
Those M Audio DSM 2s in the background. It's crazy.
How long
have
you had those? And what do you like about them?
Since 2009. Again, I'm just so used to them. Sure. I've tried a few other speakers. I do need to get some new speakers for this new room. Mm-hmm. But I know them.
Yeah. It looks like they're a non-ported design. Do they have a sub along with them or is it just those?
Just those. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm getting a sub for this room actually.
Gotcha. Phil says that was surprisingly great. Thanks. A lot of comments along those lines. I should be reading more of these. A lot of people saying just wonderfully nice things about your work on this. I'm trying to filter through and find questions, so I'm sorry if I'm skipping over all these compliments, but let me know, Catherine. There's a ton of them. Michael O'Rourke asks, hey, Catherine, do you use ozone from Isotope? Much love from Ireland.
I do. I have started, as I said before, it's using ozone is sort of a little bit like crack, kind of. It's plug-in crack immediately makes everything sound way better and you're not entirely sure why. But I've started to be more conscious of what I'm using it for and getting into kind of the more detailed aspects of it rather than just, you know, putting it over for kind of a quick immediate fixes.
Gotcha.
So, yes, I do.
All right. A couple more little questions here. I think we're getting towards the end of that. I really appreciate your time. We've had Catherine here for almost 45 minutes after a killer hour-long presentation from her. So really pleased to have had you here. Phil says this was inspiring and wholesome as hell. So it's great to hear. Marco asks, what sample rate is the project? And do you ever have any problem using saturation in the box with upsampling? So he wants to know about your sample rate and if you think there's ever a problem using saturation internally inside of a computer.
I don't know what the saturation means internally and what that has to do with sample rate, but that mix was running at 24-bit 48K.
Yeah.
And in fact, most of my mix sessions are, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, some people are of the belief that that there could be aliasing problems when you're applying saturation because let's say you have a frequency of like 20K that is now you're applying extra harmonics on top of it because of the saturation. And now it's generating new frequency content that's above 20K. And could that cause aliasing? But I think the plugin itself basically should be, if it's properly designed, basically rejecting those frequencies and then filtering them back out again. So it's generally shouldn't be a problem, I think, in any well-designed plugin. But it is a question I've seen come up in nerdy esoteric forums as of late, for some reason, that people are worried about whether saturators are causing aliasing. And I think the answer should be no in any properly designed plugin, that they're basically going to reject frequencies above a certain amount based on the sample rate of the session. So I hope that's a useful answer. I don't know. All right. Here's one about a specific song. I don't know if you're going to be able to answer this one, but let's give it a try. Bayou says, hi, curious, how do you do the vocal loop or delay in the Wolf Alice song, How Can I Make It Okay? It's so cool. Do you have any remembrance of this?
I didn't work on that song.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Which Wolf Alice projects did you work on?
I worked on their first EP, which has Moaning Lisa Smile and Storms on it.
So
the confusion that people get is because Moaning Lisa Smile went on their first LP.
Yep.
And was what their first single.
Yeah, it was a big hit for them, yeah.
Yeah. Was nominated for a Grammy.
Yep.
So
you technically worked on the LP by working on the EP and songs from that went on the LP.
Exactly, yes.
Gotcha. All right.
But Mike Crossey did their first record. Yeah.
Gotcha. Cool. Ty, the sound guy, wanted to clarify about his thing about using backing tracks. He says, Catherine makes a great point. One thing I'd say is to have elements from the record played and performed via controllers live so that the tempo and feel can change according to the night. So that's one workaround he has of working in backing tracks in a more organic way. So I wanted to read out that comment.
Of course, yeah.
But Nate Sani says he likes your view on backing tracks and to the extent that they limit your ability to riff with the crowd. I think that's an interesting part of performance that people don't always think about, is that the audience is almost a part of the performance to really good performers. So they really interact with them. John Sand asks, hi, do you automate into your reverbs? I believe there's a bunch of automation in your mixes, but specifically the question is there, are you using automation into effects like reverb?
Yes. Did I show them on the video? I can't remember.
I can't remember off the top of my head. I think I definitely remember seeing automation into delays, almost for sure. I remember seeing your automation of de-essing, which I thought was really interesting, that you kind of go in and manually draw those down. I can't remember off the top of my head whether you're showing...
But yes, I do, definitely, especially those big swirl reverbs, you know, mm-hmm. the sort of on the word ghost, it was, you know, I want to kind of swell that really nicely into the send so that then that kind of blooms out just at the tail end of the word.
I can see that visually in my head now, seeing the automation specifically on that word. And maybe, you know, watching it, it's not clear to someone whether it's a volume automation or a reverb automation, but it sounds like a reverb send automation.
Yeah, cool. It is. Yeah.
Man, some of the vocals near the end of this song, there's just such a big payoff, like 2/3 of the way through or so. It's just like, oh, this song is cool. And then it gets cooler. So congrats on really helping that stuff to come out. Let's see here. Pat was asking you to perform automation before or after effects. It sounds like more of the automation is probably going into your reverbs and coming back from them, I'd imagine. But do you do automation on the returns as well, or just on the sends, is his question?
Just usually on the sends. Occasionally I will automate the returns, but because I'm sending so many things to a lot of those returns, I usually just keep them flat. I might automate them in the middle of everything in the middle of the song. So if I've got, I think I showed you my kind of bank of delays and reverb returns, and I might group them and, you know, kind of ride them out. You know, if there's a break in the song and I want the kind of all the swells and the delays to disappear for a minute.
Pedro asks, the rumor of collaboration with Taylor Swift, is it true? Do you know of a rumor about you collaborating with Taylor Swift? And can you comment on the truth or lack of truth?
Oh, I do know about this rumor.
All right. And can you say anything about it?
Part of me wants to keep the dream alive and say I can't talk about it. But I should be honest and say, unfortunately, the rumor is not true. But I would love to work with Taylor Swift.
All right. All right. Hopefully it'll be true as of today. Maybe Pedro here is one of the people planting seeds of this rumor. So Pedro, if you've been planting seeds, continue to plant them and see continue. If they bear fruit. I think Catherine would be very happy about that. All right, we're coming close to an hour here now. So, Catherine, Okay. Thank you so much for being generous with your time. Let me see if I can get the last question or two from here, and then we'll let you get back to your busy day. I know you've got some shows. So I think you're going to a Natalie Imbruglia concert tonight, one of your clients.
I am Nat. If you ever say this, Justin is the reason that I'm running late.
Oh, no. All right. If we're running late, okay, so here's the last questions. At all, Bernardo Reyes is annoyed that I didn't ask you what your favorite sandwich was. I kind of glossed over that one, but now he's coming to ask again. Can you ask her what her favorite sandwich is? I don't know if this has to do with music production.
I don't eat many sandwiches these days, but if I do, it's ham and cheese.
Okay, good answer. Bernardo, I hope you're happy. You just made her even later for the Natalie Imbruglia concert because of asking this question. Okay. Last two questions for you, I promise. Number one, do you mix in headphones? And if so, any tricks on making that work? That's from Videos for Good Life.
I sometimes forget, but sometimes I do. I try and force myself to, at the end of this mixing, to kind of do all the detail stuff to put headphones on. Mind you, when I was in Australia last year and I did, I mixed a record, I did that on headphones at my mum and dad's house in the countryside. Mm-hmm. And I used my Beats headphones that I won when I won my Music Producers Guild Award.
Nice. All right. Hey, if you want to win things without having to be a great producer like Catherine Marks, we do have a MixCon mega giveaway right now. We're giving away more than $10,000 worth of free gear. So check the link in the description and in the comments, or just Google MixCon mega giveaway. You got more than 10, you got more than, I think, three chances to win up to $10,000 worth of gear, including some nice monitors and a whole bunch of cool stuff. So check that out. Last question, I think this is a good one to end it on, and then we will let Catherine get back to her busy day. Thanks again so much for your time today. Last question will have to be from Alberto. I'm sorry if I missed your question. There's even more questions here, but I really want to be respectful of Catherine's time. So Alberto, you get the last one from Copenhagen, Denmark. He says, Catherine, how do you suggest to get your first clients as a rookie producer?
That is a good question. The way I did it was, when I started working for a major, was I just worked with Foles. So I'd engineered Holy Fire. And then I just asked my manager to give me a bunch of meetings with record labels. Mm-hmm. And so I had a body of work, you know, there that people could see. They could see the kind of artists that I'd worked with. They could see who my mentors were. And then I just went and not badgered them, but just was like, hi, here I am. So that's how I did that with working with record labels. But as far as getting your first client, you know, being a rookie, having never done it, start recording your friends. Mm-hmm. One of the first productions actually I ever did was for something that never ever got released. Mm. And it helped me learn get a lot of the mistakes out of my system, to get to try a lot of the things that I thought a producer was supposed to do, then realize that's not what you're supposed to do. There was a lot of stuff that I did for free from an engineering point of view, or Flood couldn't do and he'd sort of throw me in the deep end for stuff. It's just to kind of cut your teeth and kind of try and get as much experience as possible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is a long game. So definitely something to think of. And Catherine, like you said, you were in the audio engineering world for almost a decade before you were really confident to take on the big projects yourself. Is that roughly kind of what you said?
Exactly. Yeah. And even then, you know, I sort of faltered at the starting line. You know, there was the particular artist that I was working with at the time, the track that we'd done together had like such massive success. They were feeling the pressure. I was feeling pressure from management and record labels. And I was too overwhelmed and not equipped to deal with how to manage their sense of feeling under pressure, because, you know, I was trying to appease everyone and not experienced enough. I'm sure at one point I'm like, oh my God, my career's over. But it was just an amazing learning experience.
Right. That's great to know. And I think it's been said in more than one industry that's not always just about who's best, it's also about who's left. So the ability to kind of stick with it, you know, over the long haul and in face of things like that is a huge part of success in major careers. Speaking of major careers, Catherine, I'm a huge fan of so much of the work that you've done. I've personally listened to so many of the records on your discography, and I really loved seeing your approach to this. A lot of people have written into the comments to see to say exactly the same. I thought it was really refreshing and a really fun song. And it was hard for me to find all the questions because there were so many comments in here about just how much they liked seeing the way you work and how much they liked the song, especially when you're playing like that end third of the song and just kind of letting it go and you were just rocking out to it. The whole audience was. So I had to filter through all the comments about how great it was in order to find the question. So if I missed yours, that's part of why. I'm sorry you just liked it too much for me to find your question. Thank you again, Catherine. Thank you also to Manchester Orchestra for letting us do this and helping us go under the hood of this track. A big thanks to Sound Toys for helping make this one free to the public. Catherine uses their tools all over here. You can see the Altar Boy, the Echo Boy, the Micro Shift, the Decapitator, the Devil Ox. Those are some of my favorites. So really great to see that. And Catherine, if people want to keep up with you and find more about you, what are the best places to keep up with you online?
My Instagram account at CJ Marks. Right. And then that's got all the details on there.
Good stuff. All right. Well, Catherine, thank you again for joining us. Thank you guys for hanging out with us. This has been Justin Coletti of Sonic Scoop with Catherine Marks for MixCon. See you next time.
Thank you.
All right. And we are clear. Thank